Our first presenter today is Lori Chow. Lori is a registered dietitian working at the Provincial Mental Health Metabolic Program at BC Children's Hospital. She has helped write the Healthy Living Toolkits for Professionals, a toolkit that helps health professionals address healthy eating in children and youth with mental health challenges. So go ahead, please, Lori.
So today I'm just going to be talking about the link between mental health and nutrition, and then a few of the common challenges that I see related to mental health involving nutrition. Before I get going into it, I just wanted to talk about a few of the resources that I'll be referring to today. And they're available on the KELT website, and they have information on eating and mental health. There are healthy living toolkits for families and for professionals that are available that have general nutrition information for children and youth with mental health challenges. And the family guide was developed by the FORCE along with BC Children's and BC Mental Health and Substance Use Services, and has tips that are actually from parents who have children and youth with mental health challenges that can be quite helpful. And there's also a patient and family guide to second generation antipsychotics that discusses more specific nutrition and physical activity for some of the side effects associated with taking a second generation medication. So to start off, there's many different connections that can be made between mental health and nutrition. And today I am going to talk about some of the more broad connections as opposed to more specific nutritional concerns that would be related to specific diagnoses. For more specific information, the Healthy Living Toolkit for Professionals has a section on common nutrition findings in the specific mental health challenges in children and youth, and it has a summary of current evidence and recommendations. For the broader links that I wanted to talk about, there's sort of four broad links, one of them being that many mental health challenges are associated with significant appetite and weight changes that can either be related to mood or to medications that are commonly prescribed. The second link related to mental health challenges are that there's a lot of micronutrient deficiencies and excesses that can be related either to typical eating habits, such as commonly found in autism, that there's iron deficiency, or related to alternative therapies that are often used to try and help children and youth with mental health challenges. For more specific detail about specific nutrients and diet-related therapies for mental health challenges, the Healthy Living Toolkit for Professionals has a good table in their outlying current evidence on that. Another major link between nutrition and mental health that's a little different is that there's a lot of poverty and social isolation, which are really commonly associated with mental health challenges, and can really affect food security and compound nutrition-related problems. So for example, a study that was done on depressed versus non-depressed adults, the depressed adults were 2.5 times more likely to have food security problems and almost 3 times more likely to need help with preparing meals. So this can be a big challenge in this area. And then a fourth, common link between mental health and nutrition is that there's a high level of comorbidities that can impact health. So specifically, there's a lot of cardiovascular morbidity in a lot of mental health diagnoses. Later in life, there's also a lot of diabetes. For example, in schizophrenia, it's very common. So those four sort of broad topics are sort of major nutrition issues that are linked to mental health. In talking about more common nutrition challenges that I see around mental health, I'm going to talk a little bit about some solutions for some of those challenges. And when we talk about these issues, I work in a clinic at Children's for children and youth with mental health challenges and some metabolic disturbances they might have. We want sometimes families to make changes around diet, and it can be quite difficult to make these changes. And what we're looking for is longer-lasting behavior change to help improve health over a lifespan. And what we use in our clinic and what is described in the Healthy Living Toolkit are SMART goal setting, and they're just small, achievable goals. And when we know that when we're making these small goals, that the behavior change can be easier to make and can be more sustainable over the long term. So specifically, instead of New Year's is coming up, so using that as an example, instead of making a typical New Year's goal, which might be eating healthy for the rest of the year, which might be quite difficult to achieve, a SMART goal, for example, on a patient with a second-generation antipsychotic might just be increasing fiber in their toast that they eat for breakfast. And that might be increasing from 2 grams of fiber per serving to 4 grams of fiber per serving. And it's a really small, specific goal that would be achievable, and you'd feel confident that you could achieve that. So those are the type of goals that we would be making, and they're a way to slowly make changes over time. So talking more specifically about some nutrition challenges that I see, I talked a little bit about medication before, but there are two major medications that are commonly used. The first one is second-generation antipsychotics, and some of those would be risperidone or olanzapine or Abilify, and they can cause side effects that would include increasing appetite that leads to weight gain, especially around the belly. Some other side effects might be high cholesterol or elevated insulin or high prolactin. And all of these side effects can be helped with changes to diet. So for example, for an increased appetite on one of the medications, things like increasing fiber in grains or drinking fluids before meals can help make the body feel more full. So there's lots of different things that we can do around nutrition. For more information on it, there is a patient and family guide to the second-generation antipsychotics that's on Kelty, and it goes into all the different side effects and what you can help with. Another major class of medications are stimulants, such as dexedrine or Adderall or Vyvanse, and these medications can cause side effects completely the opposite of the SGAs, which can make kids much less hungry and can lead to weight loss. So nutritionally, it can be quite different. Try and use higher energy food options, scheduling regular small meals and snacks throughout the day, making sure kids aren't drinking before or during a meal to try and so their tummy won't get filled up with fluids. Try different ways to cope with the different side effects. Some kids have found it really helpful to have a bag of trail mix in their pocket that they can munch on throughout the day when they're not hungry. And there's other more information about stimulants website under medications. It has some good nutritional some good nutrition tips. Another sort of common thing that we find in children and youth with mental health challenges is that they can have more picky eating, I guess I could say. Most kids have picky eating, but in mental health challenges, it seems to be more often or more severe. So for general picky eating, the suggestion that we try and make is to maintain what we would call the division of responsibility. What that essentially means is that parents eat short order cooks. So they would have regular scheduled meals and snacks, and children can choose to eat food provided or not. And normally there would be one thing on the table that the child or youth would be okay with eating. And then over time, preferences will slowly expand without having major battles around food at the table. The Healthy Living Toolkit for Families has lots more great suggestions around encouraging kids to try more foods. And the last thing that I wanted to talk about is using food as a reward for behavior. So I'm finding quite regularly that people use food as a reward for good behavior or for helping kids when they aren't feeling well. And it does work quite well for encouraging good behavior, so I can see why people go to it. This is an option. But what ends up happening is that you're linking food with emotions, and that's something that we don't want to have happen. Food should be for nourishment. because as kids get older, they may then start to eat when they've done something well or when they feel sad. And typically because the food reward initially being offered probably wasn't carrot sticks, people end up eating a lot of food that is less than nutritious, which can lead to more problems later in life or exacerbate some of the chronic health conditions that might already be there. So that's the last challenge that I wanted to talk about. And I guess I'll pass it over to Helen now, who's going to talk about more comments.
Great. Thank you, Lori. So our next presenter is Helen Young. Helen has worked as a public health dietitian with Vancouver Coastal Health for the past 20 years, mostly with children, youth, and their families. In her current role, she works with school staff, administrators, parents, and community members to promote healthy living in all children and youth. She is also a dietitian with the North Shore Eating Disorders Program, seeing youth aged 11 to 18 years who are struggling with disordered eating or eating disorders. Helen participates on the North Shore Education Committee for the Prevention of Disordered Eating, which includes representatives from public health, mental health, school districts, and family services of the North Shore. Welcome, Helen.
Thanks, Kaylee. Thanks for having me on your panel today. I'm happy to be reviewing some nutrition messages and strategies that can help promote healthy eating and positive mental health in children and youth. So Lori kind of covered specific individual nutrition issues, and I'm kind of going from the close-up lens to the more wide-angle lens. As a community dietitian, I work with not only individuals, but with families, with the school environment, with school staff, and then beyond, including the food suppliers and people in the community centers, other service providers. And so as I go through the nutrition issues, I'd like you to think about how you could affect change in the youth that you're working with. And a neat model that I use quite a lot is the comprehensive school health model. Comprehensive school health is used in schools as well as by public health to make sure that we are doing action in all four pillars. And four pillars are relationships in an environment. So that would include the social and the physical environment. Teaching and learning, which is mostly the area for teachers. Then there's community partnerships, and the fourth pillar is policy. And so in all those four areas, I think if we have coordinated action, then we can sort of affect more change effectively. So in thinking about the topic of nutrition and mental health, there's so many subtopics one could choose. And I'm just going to talk about three common nutrition issues that youth and parents and teachers talk to me about quite often. The first one is body image concerns, which often drive youth's eating behavior or their non-eating behavior and their attitudes. The second is skipping breakfast, not eating breakfast. And the third is lunch, teens wanting new ideas for tasty, healthy lunches, and sometimes not having enough time for lunch. So I thought we could just talk about healthy eating in the context of those three common nutrition issues. So the first one around body image concerns, it's quite well known that youth worry about their weight, their looks, and in general it could be developmental stage, but I do believe it is a big part of the society's emphasis on the thin ideal, and in men it would be also the muscular ideal. And the message that youth receive is you can look like the models in this magazine if you just try hard enough. The message they believe is that if you diet enough or you exercise enough, you can change your body. And one way to illustrate that is I'll ask them to think about someone who's really tall, an adult who's really tall. And once they've thought about that, I'll say, would you say to that person, you're over height, you should try to lose some inches. Or, you know, if you've got big feet, I think you should try to shrink your feet. And I think then they kind of realize that your adult height isn't changeable, and neither is your body shape or size. It is, of course, to a certain extent, you can change your body size, but there is a genetic limit. And the message I'd like people to remember is just to be the best you can be with what you have. Every body benefits from being active and eating well. So being active meaning, you know, about an hour a day for children and youth of enjoyable, moderate activity. And then for preteens, because I do work a lot with the intermediate grades, grades 4 to 7, and then the early high school grades, I think that for preteens, like the 10 to 12-year-olds, they worry a lot about their changing bodies, and they don't realize that part of normal growth is that your body will increase its weight before it increases its height. It's almost like your body is getting ready for the growth spurt by sort of proportionally increasing the weight before they shoot up. And so they need to know that that's just part of normal growth. And to achieve a healthy weight, it would be eating well. And when I say eating well, I'm talking about both the quality and the quantity. So many times people will say to me, well, how can I lose weight on a healthy diet? And so I usually say that your body does give you signals in terms of how much it needs. And so we need to think about that. And some of the school districts are looking at self-regulation quite a bit. And so it's looking at what emotion are you feeling. It's managing your feelings, your thoughts, and, you know, being able to manage your behavior. So along the lines of this, I would say eating fits into this because it's kind of like your body will tell you if it is hunger. You know, ask yourself, if it's hungry, then I might need food. Is it thirst that I'm sensing? Because many children and youth might forget to drink throughout the day, and that also affects your ability to concentrate. It affects your mood in the same way that not eating enough will. And children also need to know that dieting, restrictive dieting, can lead to irritability, mood swings. It affects your social interaction then when you're, and this is a preventable problem, because I think that there are some illnesses which you can't really prevent, but in terms of what I'm talking about, it is a preventable problem to be able to learn better and to feel better if you are eating regular meals and snacks. So it kind of works out to be about every three hours in the daytime. So that's, I'm kind of talking about dieting concerns. And now I'm going to just talk about a shift in attitudes and how we message eating. Because I think a lot of people think about good foods and bad foods. And it's like, oh, I was so good, I had a salad for lunch. Or I was so bad, I ate 2 pieces of cake. And I think that it's changing the language we use so that if we're teaching kids about nutrition, to talk about everyday foods and the sometimes foods. And just to take that moralistic slant off our language when we talk about foods. So if I choose to eat an apple as a snack instead of a chocolate bar, it's not because I'm morally better, or it's because I choose to look after my health. I care, and it becomes more about self-care rather than good or bad. Healthy eating is defined by flexibility, moderation, and balance, and not rigidity. So there's a lot of talk about mindful eating and intuitive eating, where you savor the food, you're really aware of the taste and texture. So if you're eating an orange, you can savor the taste, the juiciness, think about the, is it sweet, is this tart? You can even smell the oils from the skin when you're peeling it, and just appreciate how that piece of food got to you. So the other part of what affects youth's food choices is asking why they eat the foods they eat. And so besides body image concerns, most youth will say because the food's there, right? But that's a big reason they eat for convenience. So they will eat what's in their school, what's in their bag, what's in their homes, And so one of the things I wanted to mention is that BC has the guidelines for food and beverage sales in BC schools, and we've been using the 2010 guidelines, but they have been in place for the last 8 or 9 years. And there will be new revised guidelines coming out soon. But I think that if we asked how can we improve the health of the whole population of children and youth, I would say that that has been a beneficial thing to have the guidelines for food and beverage sales, because it's created healthy choices within schools for foods that are sold to students. So kids in grade 8 actually might have gone through their whole elementary school for the last 7 years without actually having pop and candy and chocolate bars for sale in the schools. So if they are trying to make healthy eating the easy choice, it has, I think, happened. And some people think of the guidelines as being restrictive and not allowing choice, but I think of it as opening up choices, because more food vendors have come up with maybe healthier options, soup and sandwiches, or schools are offering salads, and this could be at the elementary level. There could be some Asian dishes and new things rather than just hot dog and pizzas. So I save it as an opening up of new vegetarian items and sushi and pasta salads. So I think it actually helps make healthy choices the easy choice for all the students. So what to do about the other challenges of breakfast, not having time for breakfast and lunch? Well, I think it depends on what are the underlying issues. And if you're working in a school or a community and you're wondering why is it that kids are skipping breakfast, there's, you know, could be dozens of different reasons. It'll vary on the community. Is it poverty or food insecurity that Lori touched on? Or is it that the parents are working two jobs and they're dropping their kids off before 8 every morning and don't have the time? Is it a lack of food skills or not knowing what can we make for breakfast? So going back to the close-up lens for breakfast, you can think about just thinking outside, you know, the traditional breakfast menus. I do encourage people to think about adding protein to the meals, because adding protein and fiber helps one concentrate and learn better. So some people will say, I'll eat 2 or 3 slices of toast for the morning and then I'm still hungry and I don't feel very good. And I would try to plan your breakfast so that you have at least 3 different food groups represented. So maybe instead of like 3 pieces of plain toast, have 1 or 2, but put peanut butter on, add some fruit, have a glass of milk or milk alternative, and that way you're adding some protein and some fiber from the fruit. And it's fine if you want to have sweet potato, or you want to have, like in some cultures, they'll eat rice and fish. It doesn't have to be the traditional breakfast foods, because then you actually enlarge the variety of foods available. So recognizing also that the factors that influence our food choices is not just health. We've been talking about healthy eating, but obviously children and youth will eat what's tasty, what's convenient, and people have to think about the cost of foods for breakfast and lunch. I did want to tell people that we have a resource on the Vancouver Coastal Health, our EduHealth website, and if you just Google VCH Lunches to Go, you can get the Lunches to Go handout. And the way I use that with classrooms, some schools actually post it up on their bulletin board, and it gives parents, you know, some ideas in case they kind of are in a rut of what to serve and you're kind of having the same thing all the time. So Lunches to Go, and some parents will have the kids go through and check off what they like, and then they'll make a list, a shopping list from it. Because there's one thing of having the ideas, but there's another of making a plan to have it come from the grocery store and make it onto your plate and have it eaten. The other handout from VCH, Vancouver Coastal Health, is Fueling Your Mind and Body. And that handout is for youth. And it kind of goes through not only the what of healthy eating, but the how. Because both the how and the what are equally important. And the last, I guess, strategy or tip for helping youth eat better is just eating together, because I know that without sounding, you know, moralistic about what you should be eating together, there is a lot of research showing the benefits of families eating together. And I'll just list a few things that the association between children eating with their family members, they develop a sense of belonging, they have higher self-esteem, they are eating healthier, and they're also less likely to smoke or use substances and have disordered eating. And for parents, then parents can eat healthier and save money, but also they're a role model for the kids. And, you know, when I talk about eating together with families, it doesn't have to make you feel guilty. It can be, you know, starting with weekend dinners or maybe an evening snack if you're not able to make weekly, you know, every daily dinners a habit. It's just to remember that sometimes eating together is better than no times, just because that connection, sometimes the only time we can give 100% of our attention to each other. So those are just a few tips. And yeah, just to summarize, what I'll say, the four cornerstones for promoting positive body image while we're promoting healthy living is to model healthy behaviors, and that includes both eating behaviors as well as non-dieting. So just watching our language and not saying, oh, I shouldn't eat that because it has too many calories, it'll make me fat. I think that's not really helpful. And the second is to provide an environment that makes it easy for youth to make healthy choices, both physical activity and eating, and focus less on weight, instead focus on health, behaviors, and attitudes, and then just provide a supportive environment where there's lots of talking and lots of listening.
Great. Thank you, Helen. And those resources that both Lori and Helen mentioned, I will link to the events page after this, so they'll be easy for everyone to find. Our last presenter today is Brent Seal. Brent is a fourth youth in residence at the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center who has lived with schizophrenia since 2007. For the past 2 years, he has been studying and applying nutrition strategies that have helped him manage symptoms, improve his mood and energy, achieve and maintain a healthy body weight, and run his first ultra marathon. Brent promotes a results-focused, guilt-free approach to nutrition that is simple and sustainable. So, welcome, Brent, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I just want to share a bit of kind of how I got into mental health and how I stumbled into nutrition, and some lessons I learned along the way of my journey. So as Kaylee mentioned, I was diagnosed with schizophrenia in 2007. It was my second episode of psychosis, and at that time, with my relapse, I increased my medication, which were antipsychotics, quite a bit, and I started to experience some side effects from those medications, including weight gain, low energy. Eventually, my prolactin levels went up, so a number of side effects kind of started to happen. And I realized I need to kind of take control of my health. And, you know, the symptoms were managed and manageable mental health-wise, but I knew to be truly healthy, I need to look at my diet and my exercise routine and my overall health to really thrive. So that was kind of 2007 to 2012. I was kind of struggling with this low energy, weight gain, and just not really feeling fully alive. In the spring of 2012, I decided to do a wellness challenge, and I decided to do everything all at once. I decided to like add in all these great things like drinking green tea and going to sleep on time and exercising 5 days a week and all this kind of great stuff, and decrease all these bad habits of like going to bed too late and drinking coffee and alcohol and eating fast food and all that kind of stuff. So I did the wellness challenge for the month of February of 2012. It lasted about 5 days until I was completely overwhelmed and just defeated by it because it was way too much to try all at once. But at that time, my weight just kept increasing, and I realized I had to do something pretty quickly to deal with that. So I decided to just focus on one thing, which was exercise. And as soon as I just started focusing on exercising and getting a bit of momentum with that, I all of a sudden naturally wanted to eat healthier. And with my girlfriend, who has a real high commitment to her own health, we started studying nutrition and reading books about it. And we started kind of moving towards a vegan diet of just trying to increase our micronutrients, because one thing we quickly realized was the typical diet is high in macronutrients or calories and low in micronutrients. And so we tried to just shift that towards more micronutrients in our diet. And the books we were reading were kind of driving us towards veganism. But we also realized that was a really restrictive way of eating. It wasn't as much for ethical reasons. It was more for the health benefits. And it just seemed too difficult to kind of implement in our lives. Which is where we came across this idea from a guy in Squamish, Adam Hart, who runs his company Power of Food, this idea of 80-20 principle towards eating. And the idea is 80% really healthy, whole foods, plant-based diet, 20% eat whatever you want. It's a guilt-free way of eating, and it allows you to go for a burger and a beer with some friends at a pub or eat some chips or fast food whenever you want, but I'm trying to focus on 80% kind of having that really healthy, nutritious food. So as soon as I came across that concept, it was just really attainable for us, and we started trying that out. The kind of challenges I was facing were energy, weight gain, and prolactin. So as I was exercising more, eating a bit healthier, my energy was coming back, and I also ended up switching medication because the prolactin issues got so bad that I kind of was forced to switch medications. So the combination around that time, around that spring, of switching the medication, improving the diet, and exercising more allowed me over a one-year period to reduce my weight to a more healthy level, get my energy back, and get into running to the point where I completed an ultra marathon and just live through my daily life full of energy. And also balance my mental health as well, even more. I was always, for the last few years previous, having symptoms here and there, and that seemed to improve with this better way of living. So the idea of 80-20 principle helped. Again, it was, so the three kind of things I was trying to achieve is increase the amount of micronutrients I was getting, increase the quality of the macronutrients, so the carbs, the protein, and the fats. I'm not someone to say, you know, don't eat fat, don't eat carbs, and all this kind of stuff. Just increase the quality of it. So get really healthy carbs, low on the glycemic index, complex carbs, high quality proteins from plants and from better sources of meat, lean meats, and good sources of fat. So one idea around the fats was I realized omega-3s were related to my mental health somehow, and just learning about how every brain cell is covered in a layer of fat and that you need omega-3s to kind of keep that a healthy layer of fat. Otherwise, it kind of gets crusty and the communication in the brain kind of is impacted by that. And omega-3s you can get from plants, but there's three types of omega-3s. So getting just better sources of omega-3s, which I realized I could get through algaes, things like marine phytoplankton and chlorella, because some of the fish omega-3s are full of toxins just because of our planet. I was just learning kind of these concepts, the ideas of adding adaptogens into our diet, things like goji berries and maca, things that naturally balance our hormones, and just adding those into smoothies and feeling the effects of that. And so I just get to the point of increasing what I'm doing in my life, in my career, and my fitness, but not feeling more stressed because of it, because of the healthy diet. Learning about the relationship between the gut health and your probiotics and your bacteria and your gut and your body, and that relationship to the brain, and realizing how important probiotics are, and learning about the number of probiotics that you get in like some probiotic yogurt, and comparing that to a probiotic supplement. And that's a big difference in the amount of probiotics that are there, but there's also a big difference in cost. So you get about 3 or 4 billion active cultures in your average yogurt product, and in a supplement you got about 50 billion active cultures, but it's also a big differentiation in cost. And then I came across a thing called kefir, which is kind of like yogurt. It comes in a little tub. It's got about the amount of probiotics in a supplement, but the cost of yogurt. So I just started adding that to my smoothies. And and again, just really getting into smoothies and as a great, easy way to add the micronutrients, to add high-quality macronutrients, and add some of these superfoods in that just round out the corners of mental health and overall health and energy. Also, just the idea of decreasing toxins in my diet. So going towards more organic, and you might say, oh, organic's expensive, but you can find pretty decently priced organic foods at local markets. That's what we found, is getting a lot of our produce at local markets, and one we found near our house is pretty reasonably priced, and compared to bigger chains of food, it's often comparable to non-organic produce. So just these three kind of ideas of increasing the amount of micronutrients, increasing the quality of macronutrients, decreasing the toxins, have kind of provided all these benefits. The way we did that is through the 80-20 principle, 80% whole foods, plant-based, and just the adding in principle of adding in the good, and that helps crowd out the bad. And yeah, that's the other things that kind of naturally happened was just decreasing the amount of processed foods through this way of eating, decreasing the amount of meat, dairy, gluten, and this kind of naturally happened by aiming for 80% whole foods, plant-based. And yeah, it's just been an incredible journey of the last couple of years. It's been about a year and a half of applying this way of eating. I don't consider it a diet, because I think diets are kind of set you up to fail, because they're short-term, they restrict calories often, and your body goes into some other mode of holding weight, because that's just a whole poor concept towards eating, and this is more just a lifelong way that we plan to eat that's sustainable, and that's important, I think, in your eating plan. It has to be sustainable, and that's where Lori was talking about earlier, setting small, smart, achievable goals, and that's the reason my wellness challenge in February 2012 did not work, because it was massive goals all at once and it was overwhelming. Whereas after that, just applying some simple, easy steps of adding some healthier habits in was more sustainable over the long term. And I've been able to manage that healthy weight, manage my energy, and manage my mental health successfully for the last year and a half with this kind of new way of eating and living. I think always the best results with nutrition are balanced with healthy exercise, healthy sleep and rest, and healthy mental health. So I think all those kind of four pillars together round out and promote optimal mental health. But, you know, applying some simple strategies towards nutrition doesn't have to be complex or confusing. It's just a simple idea of adding some of the good in. Keeping it simple, achievable, and keeping it sustainable. So that's kind of been my journey over the last couple of years, and it seemed to work well, and it hasn't been that difficult, because as I kind of added some of these better things in, the way it was really easy to keep doing it was I just felt so much better, and the results were so good, and it just felt so good, and everything was improving. So it was naturally easy to just keep doing more of the good and eating less of the bad stuff. So I literally went from eating fast food and kind of going to Starbucks, Tim Hortons every day to not needing that anymore, and just feeling the benefits of the better way of eating and living. And that's kind of natural intrinsic motivation to keep doing more of it, I think. So,
yeah. Great.
I don't know how we're doing for time.
No, that's great. Thank you, Brent. So what we'll do is we'll start in the room with a question, if anyone has a question, and then we will go to the phone. So is there anyone in the room that has a question for any of our panelists? Yeah, please.
For Brent, you said that you changed your medication, and you changed your dietary and your whole lifestyle. How has it affected your medication now? Have you found that your medication levels have dropped with your new lifestyle?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting piece that I got an insight into a couple months ago. I've been trying to decrease my medication because I've been healthier, and trying to convince my psychiatrist to do that, and he's been reluctant. And then I tried to decrease it in the fall from 120 milligrams of Zelbox to 100, and I started getting symptoms pretty quickly right after, and went back to him. I actually increased it back to the normal dose on my own and went back to him just to confirm that was the right thing to do. The symptoms went away again. What he explained, and Dr. Guo might be able to confirm this, but he explained that because I was fitter, because I was healthier, and my metabolism has sped up, that's actually going to make it less likely for me to decrease the medication, because if my metabolism's faster, it's going through that medication quicker. And so he kind of described me to an old man, of a 90-year-old man with a really slow metabolism, on my dose of medication would be absolutely sedated and it would be way too much medication because his metabolism is a lot slower. Whereas a young child might have to get more medication with the same illness. So it's kind of tricky in that it a lot of my motivation for getting healthier and fitter was to see if I could decrease my medication healthily and sustainably. But that hasn't turned out to be really possible so far because of that metabolism kind of things.
All right. Is there anyone on the phone that has a question for any of our panelists?
I have a question. I have a teenager who wants to gain weight, and she's thinking of going on birth control and all this other stuff to do that, and I'm trying to change her mind about that, and I'm wondering if there's anything you can tell me that she could gain weight. She's actually getting picked on for being too skinny.
Lori, maybe you could add to this after, but usually we would recommend eating more frequent snacks, and the good oils, the higher fat foods like nuts and seeds and avocado. Be liberal about, you know, cooking with oils and adding those types of foods, or if she doesn't have any food restrictions, then the cream and the cheese, that she can be more liberal with her servings of a variety of foods. And I guess the other piece to that is just, it goes back to having just a greater acceptance in our society of the fact that healthy bodies come in different sizes and shapes, and there should be a respect for all different types of bodies, instead of just assuming that there's something wrong if you're thin, or there's something wrong if you're bigger than average. So I think that there's, you know, I hope that our communities will have just greater acceptance and less judgment in general about body size.
Yeah, I find there's a lot of answers for overweight, but there's not a lot of answers for teenagers who want to gain weight. Like, I basically haven't been able to find anything on it, and she has been eating a lot more because she's trying to gain weight.
Is she genetically, like, has she always been slim? Is it a genetic
It runs in my family. We're all very slim. Very tall, very skinny.
Well, I mean, my message is to just eat well, be active, and then in the end, it's about self-acceptance, and it is sort of a body image issue, but it's as long as she has a healthy attitude about it, then I'm sure that others within the room can answer that, or if Lori, if you had anything as a clinical dietitian.
I think, Kellen, that what you're saying is the best. It sounds like it's a genetic predisposition to having a smaller body size, and I mean, you can try and help with increasing the energy density through the oils or cheeses and things, but yeah, it's more about body image and accepting.
Uh-huh. So she's not listening to me, is there a site that she can go on that would help her, like, understand that she is fine how she is and there's no need to be gaining weight and going on birth control to gain weight or taking pills to gain weight?
I was just thinking, Helen, I don't know if you know more about this, but the Being Me resource, would that be helpful?
Yeah, the Being Me resource is something that Action Schools BC distributes, and it's about promoting positive body image. It's more geared towards teachers, but you can get it online. It's available online. It's called Being Me. If you just Google that title, Action Schools BC, it does talk about respecting diverse body sizes and shapes.
So what was that again? Being Me?
Being Me, promoting positive body image. A teacher's resource for grades K to 9.
Okay.
and it's distributed through the Action Schools BC. So Action Schools BC is really teacher education to promote healthy eating and physical activity, and they also have incorporated body image into that. But another resource, if you or your daughter wants to get nutrition information, you can call HealthLink BC Dietitian Services 811, and it's a free telehealth service for non-emergency information, so that you can email them and they could email you some information, or you can just call 811 and ask for dietitian services.
So 811 dietitian?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll do that for her because she's very vocal.
Is there a question from the telehealth sites?
Hello? Yeah, this is Pam River. I wondered if somebody could look at nutrition and behaviors and how that may, nutrition may be triggered to some of the behaviors that children are experiencing. Could you cover that?
You want me to take that, Helen?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, Lori.
So there are some links between nutrition and behaviors that we found. I mean, I know skipping meals can affect behavior. Kids can get quite irritable, and their behavior can be affected with that, not having enough, I guess I would say, like, not having enough blood sugars to keep their mood in a good place. There has been some more things coming out lately, pop affecting behavior, so kids drinking pop, and we don't know exactly why this is, but it does affect behavior after ability to control emotions, and it might be, again, the blood sugars having spiked after having pop and then crashed afterwards, and that same irritability that you would get if you were having, if you would have skipped a meal. So those are a couple of things that I can think of with regards to behaviors and food. There isn't too much out there on it. Do you have any other specific questions about it?
I'm thinking of autism and the research that's showing gluten and casein being eliminated from the diet.
Yeah, so there's been a whole lot of studies on gluten and casein, and so at this point, their recommendations are still that it's the evidence is still poor that it's going to be working. For some families, they find that it does work really well, but it's not something that is a general recommendation at this time. So for some families that are trying it, we say, like, try it for a couple of weeks, try it for a month. If you see no difference in behavior, then stop, because it can be quite a restrictive diet that we're not sure about the efficacy of yet.
Lori,
does that help?
I might also add that if people are thinking that there might be allergies or intolerances, that it's good to keep a detailed food record and for a few days, linking what you eat, how much, and then when you notice symptoms, so that when you go to your healthcare practitioner, you've got a detailed diet history, because that'll help the healthcare practitioner be able to provide better advice, figure out what's going on, and it'll help the parent also.
Great.
I agree with that, and something I've tried to do with the help of my doctor is just get things tested, so you can kind of look into whatever the illness is, whether it's anxiety or depression or psychosis like myself, and just learn kind of what some common nutritional deficiencies are and try to get those tested through your doctor. One of them for myself was magnesium, and my psychiatrist was recommending me just take a magnesium supplement, but I kind of thought I was getting that through my diet. So we got it tested and realized it was fine, the levels that I was at, but other nutrients have been low, such as iron, so I'm trying to boost that up through foods and if needed, then supplements. So I think whenever you're considering supplements or nutritional deficiencies, just try to get it tested. It's often doable through a blood test.
Great. And I think we had another question in the room here. Yeah?
Yeah. Well, I just want to say, Grant, you look fantastic.
Thank you.
I guess I'm so curious about your statement about in 2012 being so overwhelmed by those fantastic goals you were setting, and that you yourself understood it was overwhelming, and you were able to recalibrate and then really unpack it to be so self-motivating and achieving today. So my question is, what shift allowed you from that overwhelming into that unpacking it to know what you really needed?
I guess a big shift happened, well, when I tried the wellness challenge and it failed so miserably, and how overwhelming it was, and just realizing how bad of a strategy that was, because it was just not doable within a month to make, you know, 5 or 10 additions that were great and 5 or 10 reductions of the bad stuff. It was just too much all at once. And, you know, 5 or 6 days in, I realized that, and I got worse after that. I just fell back into my old ways, and even worse, and didn't exercise at all, and was eating so poorly. And that realization, just to simplify it, just came from that failure, I think. And then the second part of the motivation was just setting a goal that to work towards, and a goal that got me excited. So some people say, why didn't you run a marathon? Why an ultra marathon? And just like, that's the thing that got me excited. And the reason I set that goal, it was a New Year's Day run that I started working towards. And it was because for years and years over the summer, I'd be pretty active hiking and getting outdoors. But over the winter, I'd kind of lose my fitness, and I'd be starting over from scratch in spring. So I set a goal to run a race in the middle of winter to just try to stay active over the winter. And that goal just got me excited because it was an ultra marathon. And whatever that is for anybody, I think, just whatever that is that gets you excited to work towards something positive and aspirational builds in the reason why for improving your health. So I think those two shifts came from the failing at something that didn't work, but then also having something to work towards.
And I think there was someone else who had a question over the phone, so if we could go back to you, that would be wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Go ahead.
I'm just curious to know if there's more of a positive effect from organic food versus unorganic food on mental health. Is there any like research or anything studied around that?
This is Lori talking, and I haven't found anything like that. But I don't know if Helen or Brent, if you have any input.
Well, I get that question sometimes, just is organic food better? And, you know, it's certainly better for the environment, better for the farmers. From that point of view, it is better. If you were to compare the organic, fruit with a not conventionally grown, if you're washing and peeling it, if you were to analyze it, you might not notice the difference. And so in terms of effect on mental health, I can't say, you know, scientifically that the organic food's going to improve mental health more than eating your fruits and vegetables. I think we want to promote eating fruits and vegetables, and if the cost is prohibitive to buy organic, then we wouldn't want that to be the barrier. So generally, yes, it is better to buy organic, but I can't scientifically say that we would say that you should choose organic over conventionally grown. It's more important to eat plenty of fruits and vegetables for all the nutrients they provide, and as Brent was talking about that. Did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know of any research in particular, but just the idea of decreasing the toxins to me makes sense to try to get more organic produce, especially into my diet. Just because I'm just well aware of how many toxins are out there in our environments, in our cleaning products, in our foods, and our systems, when they're overwhelmed with toxins and our liver can't process them and eliminate them quick enough, they just start building up in our bodies and our organs and our brains. So I just try to naturally eat as clean and as healthy as possible with organic. Also re-looking at all my cleaning products, and my girlfriend and I made our own laundry detergent, and we're getting natural dish soap and shower cleaning products just to decrease that toxic load on our bodies. And again, it's hard to kind of measure that difference day to day because of all the changes we're making, but It's just a general kind of direction we're trying to take towards less toxins coming into our bodies, because just the idea of those toxins building up, that's really where disease can come from, those toxins in your brain or any organs.
Thank you.
All right, we have time for maybe one more question, if there are any other questions, either in the room, on the phone, for telehealth. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Bull.
I have two questions, but I'll just pick one. I've seen a number of teens in my clinic recently who are skipping lunch at school, not necessarily because they're it's an eating disorder related issue, but because they are anxious or embarrassed in front of eating, by eating in front of people. Mm-hmm. And so I've kind of tried to creatively problem solve around that, but I'm wondering if you have any suggestions around that.
Yeah, that's interesting. It comes up quite often, and I'm hoping that others maybe on the phone can give me some ideas, because youth do tell me, oh, I'm not comfortable eating around others, and I'll say, is there a room you can go in? And because the school is set up such that they can't go anywhere except that classroom or that eating area or cafeteria, that I'll just try to say eat maybe in between classes, because then everyone's kind of like doing that. They're eating quickly between classes. It's maybe they're not watched, because then they're just rushing to and from class, and then having a bigger breakfast and then having a big snack at 3 o'clock. But it is, something I struggle with too, and I'll ask the youth, what can you, how can we problem solve a way to get adequate nutrition? Because what happens is they don't eat a big breakfast, but then they're kind of eating most of their food between 3 and 9 p.m. So, yeah, if you have any other ideas. Lori, did you have any ideas?
No, not too much more than that, Helen. I've had the similar sort of problem. So I've had patients who have not been able to eat in a classroom environment, but then, yeah, they are able to eat when they're walking in between classes where nobody can see them. And oftentimes with families, I suggest that they just sort of switch their ideas of what lunch and what after-school snack is, so that the lunch is the after-school snack, and the after-school snack is the lunch. So they don't worry quite as much about how little nutrition they're getting at their lunch, and they have a much bigger after-school snack. But yeah, it's a hard issue.
All right, well, looks like we're out of time, so I just wanted to thank everyone for coming over the phone, in person, and over telehealth.